factors, which are language shift and language death. Language shift is the gradual displacement of one language by another in the lives of the community members. So a living person suddenly or slowly stops speaking one language and starts speaking another. Whereas language death specifically refers to when the last hearer of a language dies or stops using it. Both are measured along a continuum according to the number and age of speakers, the transmission of the language to children, and how many domains of the community it's used in. So is it just used in homes, or is it used at school as well, or do people use it at church, or, you know, how many different places is the language used? I'm going to use language death to refer to both of these processes because in Australia especially they are co-occurring due to colonisation. Living Aboriginal people use their languages less and less children have been learning them. At the same time, Aboriginal people have experienced both sudden and gradual genocide. But I also want you to think about the term language death critically. Do languages simply die or are they killed? And how many of these languages are actually more or less deeply asleep as opposed to finally dead? So the causes of this phenomenon of language death are quite varied. They include the fact that another language might be needed for economic survival in order to get an education or a job. Globalisation and the rise of English and other big global languages. The high cost of publishing materials. If you are a small community, you simply don't have as much money as a bigger community, and it is expensive to get books published in your own language so that you can read stories to your kids or tell your own histories in a written format. You also have political suppression, so that's aggressive things like laws that say you cannot speak this language and that kind of stuff. Then you have dispossession, relocation, and dispersion of speakers. So you take a community of speakers and you spread them out so that they can't talk to each other anymore because they're spread all over the country. That's another thing that happened in Australia. Decline of population, so simply there's less of you. Also you have the language status at home and internationally. So whether it is considered particularly prestigious to speak a language. So for example, not that there's anything wrong with French, but learning to speak French is considered very interesting and, ooh, that's quite fancy. Whereas learning to speak Wadjuri or Noongar, it's not really going to get you a lot of social brownie points in terms of how fancy or prestigious you are, especially internationally. It's kind of a bit, what are you going to use that for? And also for the speakers themselves, if their own language that they speak with each other is considered lesser, then that is a problem. And then you also have, contributing to a lot of this, is the attitudes of the community towards whether linguistic diversity is a good thing or whether monolingualism is a good thing. So in Australia, this process has already led to what was once 250 languages, now being 120 remaining, with only 12 of those being spoken by children, which is what you really need for a language to continue surviving. So I'm going to talk about monolingualism as an ideology versus language diversity as an ideology. The monolingual mindset is what it's referred to. It's the belief that there is only room for one language within a society. So in the biblical myth of the Tower of Babel, humans are condemned to speak mutually incomprehensible languages, blocking them from each other's minds as a punishment. This is still felt as a curse, but to rulers, media moguls, and economists, the benefits of communicating in one language have time and time again led to campaigns by imperialist civilizations and modern nations to spread a single standard language. So the Roman Empire's Latin and Napoleon's French, but also the fast-growing modern languages of English, Mandarin, Spanish, Hindi, Arabic, Portuguese, French, Russian, Indonesian, and Swahili. all of these are the languages that are the ones that are pushing out minority languages all around the world due to the monolingual mindset within those cultures. But there are alternative mythologies and attitudes towards language diversity, which are actually very common in areas with small language communities. Most people through most of history have lived in small language communities of 1 to 2,000 speakers. So this is whether you want to consider that interesting or normal. So one of these areas of high language diversity is Arnhem Land, which has the tradition of Warramurrungungi. She is, in their legend, the first person to step on the Australian continent. She sorted out all the right rituals so that her children would survive. As she put her children all over the continent, she would say, "This is the language you should talk. This is your language." The general attitude, as put by one Papuan man, is that it wouldn't be good if we all talked the same. We like to know where people come from. Or, as Mexican tzotzils would say, language was changed so that people would learn to live together peacefully in small groups. In Arnhem Land, you can drive through the territories of 7 languages from 4 language families, so that means as different as Germanic and Slavic and Romance languages are from each other, within a few hours. They're all very close together, and there's no geographic boundaries. It's not like there's a massive mountain or a big river you can't get over between these people. These people can and do have contact with each other, but they speak different languages. Each individual has a father language that gives them special authority and security in their ancestral lands. And the full set of languages you speak is like a passport, allowing you to enter another territory as someone trusted and familiar. They also make you immediately connected to a vast network of relatives and allies. If you don't know the language, then you can become trustworthy and familiar by learning it. Or you can visit with someone who can introduce you to the land and the people. This kind of system is not unusual and can be found in places such as Nagaland in northern India and Cameroon, and is more common the deeper into history you go. This is probably in the big picture normal, while we are the strange new creation of the homogenised great empires. This is not to say that we must go back to 1,000 people per language. It's just saying that people are capable of living and functioning cohesively in this kind of complex language system. And those that do often love it. That the simplicity of only having one or a few languages is not necessarily better and does not justify the killing or death of these other languages. Australia's aggressive monolingualism leads to an overall lack in language capability and directly harms our ability to be competitive and prosperous in an economically and socially global environment. So, on to some other arguments as to why language documentation, maintenance, and revitalisation are important. I'm going to start with the more niche academic reasons, and then I'm going to broaden out to the more like real life impacts. So documentation is what happens when a linguist goes in and works with one or more speakers to create a dictionary or a grammar, a dictionary and a grammar and some texts. Ideally you want 3. You want to know what the words are, how to put them together, and then you want some things that you can read to see what the language is like once you put it together into a narrative or whatever. And then maintenance is revitalization is when the speech community, often with the help of a linguist, takes proactive steps to halt the decline of their language, with those who already know it being supported to use it more, and helping the parent generation to teach to their children, as well as having adults who never learned the language starting to learn and use it. So, the reason this work is important to the study of linguistics is because the field is mostly concerned not so much with what individual languages are like, but with what capital L language is like as a phenomenon. So what counts as a human language? What are all the possible ways that a human language can be? In the past, this was about coming up with universal rules, so certain deep structural elements that were common across all languages. But this is not really the case anymore. Now it's more about looking at what the most common elements are and the trends of what things tend to go together. So that when you find something unusual or unique, it's interesting and doesn't actually mess up your whole theory of what human language is meant to be like, or whatever. The other thing about linguistics is that it is not like physics, where you can theorise that something like gravitational waves exists and then go out and find it. Linguistics is much more like biology, where every now and then you discover a grammatical structure or combination that no one had ever thought of before. So, in this situation, where what you're trying to do is get a big picture of all the possibilities, then each language is just as an important piece as any other. And each language that we don't get to in time, or that we find too late and can't analyse fluent conversation between speakers of multiple social relationships with facial expression and gesture, is probably taking with it an important answer to our big question of what is human language like. Then you have its significance to the study of human psychology. So across languages, they're not entirely alien ways of thinking about the world, but each language has a different set of biases of what you have to pay attention to, or how you think about things that are very abstract, like time or numbers. So you have some languages which count or think about numbers with base 6. So everybody knows all the squares of 6. They just know them. Or you have even Japanese, where the base number of their counting system is 10,000. That's as easy for them to think about as 10 is for us. And then you have the fact that each language makes that different set of grammatical choices. So each language makes choices about what you have to say and what you're allowed to be silent about. Because you can't ever, if I'm going to go and tell someone about what I did today, I'm not going to describe every single aspect of this room. I'm not going to name every single person. I'm probably not even going to say how many people were here. So I can't ever tell someone everything about experience. I must make choices about which bits of information are important and which ones aren't. So your language forces you to constantly be paying special attention to and remember different things. So languages don't differ so much in what you can say. Every language has the ability to talk about everything, but they're just different in what you must say. So in each language, you are participating in a slightly different shared mental world. And what's amazing to human psychology is that every single child is born equally capable of learning every single language. You could take any child from anywhere. You know, if I could have been born here and a day later dropped in with an Inuit community, and I would know their hundreds of different words for snow. My brain is just as capable of doing that as they are. Same with counting from base 6 or base 10,000. And so I'm going to get into even more examples just because I find it fascinating. So in oceanic languages, you can't simply say my. The word always specifies if it's my thing I'm about to eat, or my burnable object, or even my cannibalistically eaten human flesh. That's one word. You can't ever just say it's mine. You must say what category of mine it is, which means you have to know exactly this coconut is my thing that I'm going to drink from, or my thing that I'm going to eat, or my thing that I'm going to use to sit on. And then in Kayadild, which Lee mentioned before, you must know all the ways that people go about achieving goals, so that the grammatical structure for he's searching for a unicorn and he's waiting for his appointment have different structures. You must know if they are doing something that requires a certain expectation that this will happen, so you just have to wait for it, like an appointment, or whether it's something where you have to go and search and you don't know if you'll ever find it. And there's a whole bunch of other words for in that language beyond that. And then you have languages like Japanese and Korean and Nawari, which is a Nepalese language, where every verb is marked for volitionality. So whether you chose to do it or whether you did it instinctually. So if you say, I met my friend yesterday, it's different if you bumped into them than it is if you had planned to meet them for coffee. Those are two different actions. And also in Korean and Japanese, you can't presume to know the volitionality or internal states of another person. You can never say, he's thirsty. You must always say, he appears to be thirsty. So just another thing that in English we don't always have to be aware of, whether do I actually know that he's thirsty or do I just think that he's thirsty? And that's the same, then you get into a huge range of languages, this is not unusual, that have evidentials. So if I want to write down in a book that Columbus discovered America, I can't say that unless I was actually there and watched him do it. I must say, in the grammar, there is a way to indicate whether you saw it, whether you heard about it from someone else, whether you have enough pieces of other evidence that you've kind of put it together and figured it out, whether it's something that's common knowledge. These evidentials, you must always mark information with how you got that information, how you know it, which means you have to remember how you got that information and how you know it. And many other languages require you to keep running tabs on several points of relation to different people. So in another Aboriginal language, there is a word for, and it's just like a three-syllable word for, one who is my daughter and your mother, you being my daughter's daughter. And then you have, I'm not going to say the word, but it's one word in a language called Dalabon, and it's probably about 10 syllables. And this single word means, I'm afraid that the two of them, who are in odd-numbered generations with respect to one another, might go, with consequences to someone else, and without a key person knowing about it. By choosing the form of words I do, I indicate that one of those carrying out the action is a mother-in-law of mine, or equivalently respected relative. And that's, I'm going to try and read the word. Wiki manu mol kondokan. All of that. Which means that person has to know all of those bits of information, and it has to take them about a split second to figure all of that stuff out and how to put it together in a word. And the thing is that that person is not exceptional. That person is not ingenious. That person doesn't have an amazing brain. That person has a normal human brain just like you and me. So this isn't necessarily telling us anything about how amazing that language is. It's telling us about what human cognition can just do. We can just do that with our normal human brains. And each language requires slightly different combination of factors. And every now and then you encounter one where it's like, how could a person have all of that knowledge in their head? But they just do. And it's easy. Kids play games with this kind of stuff, of knowing which grammatical bit you have to put where. So, there we go. There's that bit. And then we have the need to preserve the thousands of human ways of knowing, their cultural systems, centuries of knowledge about history, biology, geology, and agriculture, as well as every piece of oral art in each of these languages, the poems, the songs, the epic tales that crisscross the country and require the teller to switch language as they cross boundaries in the story. These are all things that do not exist unless there is still a person out there who has them in their head in a way that they can make understood by someone else. Okay, so what's that? That's three reasons. Reason number four. languages can tell us about the deep history of unwritten societies. So this is historical linguistics, which is when you do something like what Sir William Jones did in 1786, and you look at Greek and Latin and Sanskrit, and you say, no philologer, which is a person who likes to read stuff, basically, could examine all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source which perhaps no longer exists. So you look at a set of languages and you figure out that they're related, which means that there must have been this other, more ancient language that no longer exists that they all spoke, which means that all those people who are now the people who speak those languages come from a population who used to all live in the same place. So in historical linguistics, you can't just take any pair of words from two languages that happen to have the same form for the same meaning and go, yay, this means they're related. Because there are languages that use the word, there's an Aboriginal language that uses the word dog for like a dingo or a dog, but it did not come from English. It came from a complete other word root. So you can't take that as evidence that two languages are related, because this can happen by chance. What you want to find are regular sound changes. So, for example, in English, there's a whole set of words where we have the th sound, so three or thunder, that in German are drei and donner. So you have a consistent sound change between German and English that is th and d, which suggests that they used to be the same thing. And then you also have, you can match irregular paradigms. So things like in English, we have good, better, best, which you must learn. You cannot figure it out by following the rules of English, because if you followed the rules of English, it would be good, gooder, goodest. But we do this weird thing where we say good, better, best. And in German, they do the same thing. They say gut, besser, bester. So that is much stronger evidence than simply good and gut sound the same, because the likelihood of that happening by chance is next to nothing. And yes, English and German are very, very related. They are both West Germanic languages, which is part of the Germanic family, which is part of the Indo-European family. Or you can find a set of words all relating to one topic. So in South America, there are languages that share the word for maize, words for foods made from maize, word for what time of year to plant maize, words for different parts of the maize plant. So that whole package of words was inherited from one language to another, or shared from a common ancestor. And the thing is that every witness language, so every current daughter language, has part of the story. Each language changes the older, what we call a proto-language, because we have to kind of come up with what it would have been like in a different way. So one may have the information about vowel length, one has the consonant clusters, etc., etc. And any language can be the missing link that shows how another language connects to a broader language family. So this is a big, it's a whole academic field, but I'm going to try and break it down. So what you do is you start with these branches of family trees, and from that you can get a particular chronological order of who started from where. And you can combine this with the source and timing of loanwords to get who was next door to who. And then you can add the linguistic patterning absorbed through long-term language contact, get an idea of how long and close the contact between two languages was. And so this process can do things like link the Nardené languages of Canada and Alaska, plus Navajo and Apache, which are like United States languages quite far south. These are linked to the Yeniseian languages of north-central Siberia. And historical linguists have been able to show that the last of these north-central Siberian people arrived in the Americas about 4,500 years ago. There we go. Nobody wrote that in a book anywhere. Nobody said, and on this day, we started journeying out to the Americas. Nobody wrote it down, but we figured it out. And then you have the Austronesians, who went from Taiwan and migrated across the ocean to become the Oceanic and Malayo-Polynesian peoples, stretching from Easter Island to Madagascar, which is absolutely crazy. And also through this process, you can map the long unrecorded trek of the Roma, who are the gypsies, but Roma, starting from central India, so they're not from Egypt, they're from central India, and you can track the timeline of when they moved through the whole of Europe. Again, people who didn't write any records of where they were when. So it can be tiny, tiny languages that are the ones that put the last piece of the puzzle in to say, yes, there is a link between these two. So again, that's why the documentation is absolutely vital, to go in and find that stuff so that we can make chronologies of these people's histories. And you can connect all this stuff up to archaeological evidence, and you get an even bigger, more rich picture of the history. But yes, there's a lot of this in Dying Words by Nick Evans. I guess it's a bit of an academic book, but I love it, and I wish I could just kind of like give all of it to you, but I can't. Anyway. So, and then we move on to the issue of preserving languages in order to ensure the dignity and human rights of marginalised peoples. So, throughout Australia, stripping Aboriginal peoples of their languages through direct punishment for using them, expectations of assimilation by taking people from their land and mixing them up with other Aboriginal people who all speak different languages, or putting Aboriginal children in the care of white people, by simply creating a country where it's impossible to get anything without money, which means you need a job and therefore must speak English and probably also need school, for which you also need fluent English. Aboriginal people have been subject to a concerted effort to remove their languages as a symbol and carrier of their culture, identity, humanity and agency. Much of the deep and strange grief that Aboriginal people experience on a daily basis is from this loss of both land and language. And in a time when we have started saying sorry for what happened, comes an impetus to actively work against the reverberations of genocide and assimilation. Language maintenance and revitalization is a huge part of this. To be able to say, this is where I'm from and this is the language we speak, gives a person an unreplicable sense of dignity as well as connection to country, culture, family, ancestors and other aspects of personal and shared history. And then there's also the fact that if a person speaks in a dialect or a language that is considered non-standard or not as important, it's much easier to not listen to them. It's much easier to just ignore what they're saying, because they just sound different, or they should be speaking English. And it makes it much easier to silence people once you have that kind of environment. So, on to what we're doing about it. So, the place I was working in Geraldton, it's called Bundiara Irrawonga Language Centre. Language centres in Australia use the Chickasaw model, which views the training of speech community members, linguistic analysis, documentation, and revitalization as a feedback loop. Good documentation leads to good analytical work, which enables revitalization because you have better information for people learning the language, and more people are starting to do it. So then you get more community members interested in helping you and being trained in these linguistic methods, which means you have more people who know the language in the community working on it, which leads to documentation of better material, and around it goes. So we can't do this kind of linguistics documentation work where it's just like, well, we just want to get a record of this language without also doing good community work, because it makes it better and vice versa. So at Bundiara, there is one linguist, Jackie Cook, working with three Aboriginal language workers. And they work on eight languages, from the Midwest region, which range from Wadjuri with 50 living speakers, including the three women who work at Bundiara and other Bundiara staff, to Malgana, which has no surviving speakers. They've been doing documentation work on one language at a time. They started with Wadjuri, and then they did Badimaya. Each would have taken several years. So I've brought the biggest publications, which I'll put out somewhere, that resulted from that with me. So there's two dictionaries, plus a teaching resource for Badimaya. They've now turned to Warrianga, which has one living speaker left, 85-year-old Peter Salmon, who spent his whole life, probably up till yesterday, working as a stockman all over Western Australia. At the end of 2018, Bundiara staff went up to Carnarvon to make some elicitation recordings with him, and I got to work with 1 hour of this material over 3 weeks. And what I was doing was transcribing his talking Warrianga. And the type of transcription I was doing was using an orthography for that language. So basically, they'd taken our Roman alphabet and the set of sounds that are in this language and selected the right kind of symbols to go with it. So in some ways, or in many ways, the spelling of Warrianga is much easier than English because there is a one-to-one relationship between a sound and a letter. So pretty much anytime there is an R, it's that one sound. Anytime there's... If there's a P, there's never like a PH. Like, they just don't... Well, there's no fricatives. There's no F or anything in that language anyway. So the spelling of it is quite easy, but I had to basically do a deep dive into suddenly being able to tell the different sounds of this language apart, which is incredibly difficult because, just as an example, these are two different sounds in Warrianga and most Aboriginal languages. So you have N and N. N and N. So whether or not your tongue is sitting behind your teeth on the ridge, or whether your tongue is sitting between your teeth, and we do have both of these sounds in English. If you say an or anthem, your tongue goes to a different place. But in English, we don't really care. It's the same sound. But in pretty much all Aboriginal languages, those are two different sounds, which is, yes, I think most of the time with that particular sound, I was just guessing, which is fine. I was allowed to guess because all my work was edited. But that takes me about an hour to do 1 minute of Warrianga. But I managed to get through the whole hour of tape because they then spoke English for quite a bit, which was... quite useful for me because it looked like I was very, very good at what I was doing. Oh, look at all of this time that I've done. Probably half of it was in English. But quite fascinating. And quite fun to get to spend that time with him as well. He was a very funny man with stories that he got really stuck into. And that tape also included lots of the linguists trying to get him to give them grammatical information about a particular suffix on the end of a set of words. And it's very difficult as a speaker to explain grammatical information because you just use it. You don't really think about what it means. You just know that that's what you say. So... basically, they just had to keep coming up with sentences and saying, would this mean this? And he would have to say yes or no. He couldn't really say, this is what that suffix means. Yes. Anyway, I didn't get to do any actual elicitation because that's quite advanced work, but I definitely got to listen to quite a lot of it. And I also got to do things like we went with the three... language workers to a local childcare centre and started talking to them about doing Wadjuri lessons in the early learning centre. And that was great. The staff there were really excited about doing it. And the three language workers are all, they're all trained teachers, so they're allowed to do and go in and do that kind of work, and they can like tick all the boxes for the curriculum people and everything. Yes. Oh, 2 minutes? I'm nearly there. Okay, I'm almost done. So, here's a bit of my personal reflection on working up there that I wrote during the first week. So this is just me sitting down going, oh, I just need to write this down. Talk to Jackie about how it's part of the job to stop your linguist work and just listen to your Aboriginal co-workers when they're talking to you about their lives and other people. She said, how can I be an advocate for Aboriginal people if I don't listen to their stories? Even though from the perspective of white industrialised culture, it feels wrong to not be working during work time. This led me into thinking about other ways that standard workplace structures don't fit with Aboriginal ways of being and blackfella time. If they're having a conversation, they have it until they're ready to move on. Sometimes this is very quick, and sometimes it meanders. Often someone's kids will just turn up. Also, Aboriginal kinship systems and obligations, combined with high rates of violence and illness in their communities, means that the women who work here very often have to go to funerals, mediate conflicts, or take people to hospital for their family and community members. This is especially so because the kinds of people who work in this setting are, of course, going to be very respected by and embedded in their communities. It's also given me insight into some of the reasons why white people's workplace culture and expectations make it difficult for Aboriginal people to get and keep jobs. Places like Bundiara, which are run by Aboriginal senior staff and have Aboriginal culture as the status quo, are vital, not just for the language work that gets done here, but also for the people. And I just say, if you want to help, it's very unromantic, but they need money. Pretty much that's about it. Unless you want to go and become a linguist, which we don't need quite that many. Nice to have a few more, but we don't need quite that many. Really, they need money. And all of the language centres across WA and the country have stuff that they sell that you can buy. So you can buy dictionaries, you can buy posters, all this kind of stuff. If you really feel like, you know, but what should I do about it? Pretty much money. So the nearest ones to us are the Noongar Budja Language Cultural Aboriginal Corporation, Bundiara Irrawonga, where I was, and the Goldfields Aboriginal Language Centre. And there's like a full list on a particular website that I can send out if you guys just want to know where they are, even just to have a look at their websites and see what they're up to at the language centres. I would say most of them are in a similar situation of, you know, probably one linguist at a time to 8 languages, which is, you just can't do that much work. It takes a long time. But they're all very positive and very happy about their work, and it was a wonderful place to be. Okay. Thank you.